This town wants a paramedic, yielding to ambulances, remembering 9/11, and we're going to take a look at the numbers of cardiology. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's the Medic Cast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the program this week. We have a lot of great stories coming up for you later on, including three good news items to look at. And then we're going to follow that up with this week's tip of the week, which comes from an email I got from a listener a while ago asking about an explanation on the importance of narrowing pulse pressure. And you know, in the process of trying to explain that, it occurred to me that, you know what, we need to go ahead and talk about all of the numbers that go into understanding cardiology, cardiac output, stroke volume, all of that stuff. So we're going to talk about that later on in the tip segment of this episode. But before we get to all of that, I do want to remind you to follow up on all of the information here, the links for the news articles, as well as the links and additional resources that are posted for each week's tip of the week. And all of that can be found over at the MedicCast blog. That's at mediccast.com/blog. When you're over there, you'll find a link for the show notes right at the top of the page. Click that link and you can find all the episodes listed there. Scroll down and find the episode you're looking for and follow up on those links there. We cover things here in very broad detail, and it'll be your job to go and follow up on anything you hear here on the show and let yourself figure out exactly how to apply that based on your own scope of practice and your instructional and supervisory guidelines. So we'll try to keep getting good information out to you here, and you keep following up and making sure you understand how all of that works. If you want to get back in touch with me and you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, or maybe I need to make a correction about something that I said here on the show, in any case, send those emails in to me here, podmedic@mac.com. I love to hear from each and every one of you, and I hope that you will take the time to send those emails in. I respond back to every email I get, and I look forward to hearing from you, so keep them coming. We'll have more contact information later on in this episode, so you can check that out later at the end of the show or over in the show notes at medicast.com/blog. In the meantime, please remember that we are going to be producing our programs live at EMS World Expo in New Orleans coming up at the end of October. So if you are in that area or are going to be in that area and want to come down and check out the show, I highly recommend it. It's a great opportunity to meet EMS folks from all over the world, as well as get your hands on and check out some amazing new products and services all available there. And of course, your favorite ProMed Network podcasts like the MedicCast, the EMS Garage, the EMS Leadership Podcast, all of those shows are going to be there. We're going to be producing shows live from the show floor. In addition to that, EMS World Expo has given us a special promo code for our audience. So you can share this with all your friends that you can get in free to the exhibit hall. If all you want to do is go check out the exhibit hall, that's great. We can get you in for free. Use the promo code FP50. And when you put that in over at emsworldexpo.com, when you check out and getting that exhibit hall pass, it should go ahead and make it so you have nothing to pay and give you $0 to spend. So get there for free. Check out the shows over at EMS World Expo coming up here in just over a month. First item in the news today is looking at a local article that I found just from the eastern shore here of Maryland. And Queen Anne's County is talking with the town of Church Hill that wants to have their own paramedic stationed there in their fire department. In that area, they have chase paramedics that travel out and around and help out with ambulance services and things like that. And they had one stationed there on a trial basis, and they enjoyed having that paramedic close by so much that they'd like to have it be a permanent fixture. Of course, the funding for that is difficult. According to the person in the article, it costs $250,000 a year or more to have one full-time paramedic there around the clock. And that's something that just isn't in the county budget at this time. But it just points out, you know, the difficulties of managing EMS care go beyond how we deal with the patients or what kind of patients' issues we run into. There's a whole system of EMS going on underneath the surface that even those of us in the ambulances may not be aware of how we have to manage our call volume. Who's going to be, how many ambulances can we have on call? How much overtime can we approve? What's the budget even allow for? If diesel prices go up, are we going to be able to put ambulances on the streets? These are all problems that are faced by ambulance services in the country all the time. And not just about expanding services, but about trying to get services to the right people just with what they have in a timely fashion. And I think that that's important for us to be aware of. So what's going on in your region? What are you aware of as far as funding? Is there cutbacks? Are you looking at situations where they're decreasing ambulance services? Some places are cutting back. You know, they used to have 4 ambulances on call in the county and now they only have 3. And it increases call volume wait times and increases the amount of time that people are spending on the ambulances, so they aren't getting a lot of breaks. What does that cause? What kind of problems does that deal with? Does it increase the number of medical errors that occur in the back of an ambulance? These are all questions that are going to have to be answered, and I hope that some people out there are addressing this and looking at this type of article as it crops up in their region. You know, if something like this comes up with you, please send an email in or send a link to me so I can check it out and maybe feature it here on the show in a future episode, because these types of things, these behind-the-scenes EMS articles are just as important as some of the articles that we cover here that have to do with just basic patient care and ambulance response. Here's a neat article I found looking at whether or not somebody should have to yield to an ambulance if they're going faster than the ambulance is going. This seems like an unusual problem to have, but if anyone is in an area with a major highway, you may find that even if you're running lights and sirens and going at a high rate of speed, there may be people on that major highway and interstate going even faster than you are. And what's the rules with that? And a person actually wrote in a question to their local newspaper about this and received an answer back from the people there. This is something that I think is really cool because it shows the public is aware of us, and it also is a great way to get information out about how we operate and what the appropriate thing to do when an ambulance comes near them. Changing lanes, for instance. Some places that's required. If there's an emergency vehicle on the side of the road, you must change lanes to clear an open space around them. But that's not always the case. But it could be something you could tell your public about as a common courtesy. The answer, of course, is that in this particular case, their state law doesn't specifically say. It just says you must yield to the ambulance when it has an immediate approach with their emergency lights and sirens flashing and making noise. However, the local police officer that they asked about it said that if you see emergency lights in your rearview mirror approaching, even if you feel like you're going faster than they are, you should change lanes and get to the right, because obviously it's hard to judge distances in rearview mirrors, and you may not realize how quick the ambulance is moving, and they might be right up on top of you before you know it. So there's a couple of good information pieces here for the public. And this is, again, one of those articles that I point out to you to say, hey, you might be able to use an article like this to reach out and educate your public. And it's not that hard to do an article like this. Reach out to a local reporter and point out the link to them and say, we'd like to do something like this where we talk about emergency response in our community and maybe help educate your audience about how we do that. And you might be surprised how many reporters jump at the opportunity to have somebody help them write an article and come up with story ideas, because that's something that, you know, sometimes the well runs dry. I know how it is here, coming up with tip ideas every week. It seems like I've just covered stuff, you know, and have to cover it again. And, you know, I look and it's been 2 or 3 years. So it's not always easy coming up with story ideas here on the show. And I can understand how journalists would feel the same way. So if you have an idea for stories or something like this is going on in your community, let me know about it. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com and let me know how you are reaching out and educating your community. Our final story this week has to do with the fact that we remembered the occurrences of 9/11 in 2001 this past week. And there are several articles out there talking about different communities recognizing the sacrifice of the responders in that incident, in those various incidents, I should say, and just the way that the country responded to that tragic occurrence. However, I do think that this article just talks a little bit about some of the religious aspects of that. And many areas have a blue mass or a blue church service of some sort. And by blue, that means emergency services personnel, referring to uniforms. And I think that that's a great opportunity. We've had things like that here in the past, and probably will likely have them again in the future. It is a great way to recognize individuals, to bring them in front of the community in their different areas of worship, and tell them, hey, we appreciate the work you're doing. And this is a great article out of New Canaan, New Jersey, talking about a specific time when they had this type of a service just recently in recognition of 9/11's impending arrival and recognition of that. So I just wanted to point this out to you. I don't know if this is something that goes on in your community, but I do think it's a great way to appropriately remember what happened and to honor the people that are serving in your areas. And again, it's a great way to put your people, your individuals that are the first responders, next to a private citizen in a situation that isn't an emergency response, in a public and social situation where they can educate and talk and see we're just regular folks and learn how they can support us better. And these are all things that can be done through putting together a service like this or a mass like this. So I appreciate this particular article and the church there putting together this particular opportunity to recognize first responders, and I hope that your communities are doing something similar. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and as I said, we're going to go ahead and look at the numbers behind cardiology, understanding everything we report on, the vital signs, and what exactly those numbers add up to, and what some of the variations in reading cardiology numbers might mean in different patient and treatment outcomes. So we're going to go ahead and look at that with the numbers of cardiology. So what are we going to talk about with the numbers of cardiology? Well, this is going to be a basic review for some of you, and some of the things might be new, but I think it's important for us to revisit some of these things, so I hope you'll all stay tuned. We're going to be talking about cardiac system review, just kind of an overview of what's going on. We'll talk about the heart rate, stroke volume, ejection fraction, cardiac output, blood pressure, pulse pressure, and the mean arterial pressure. And then we'll put all of that together. Now, I may have missed something that you review, and you should get back in touch with me and let me know if there's something else I should have included in this. But this, I think, covers most of the numbers that we're going to deal with on a day-to-day basis, except in a very specialized setting. Now, the cardiovascular system is a closed system, remember, and it is composed of three parts, and all of those parts interact with each other. Nothing happens in a vacuum in the cardiovascular system. If one part of it is affected, it affects some signs and symptoms in the other two parts. So we got the three parts here, the heart, which is the pump. We have the container, which is the vessels, the pipes that stuff gets pumped through, and of course the fluid, the blood, and that includes the plasma and the cells and the solids and the dissolved gases, all of that in the blood. And it's a closed system. Remember, if the blood is leaking out of the vessels because of trauma, then the pump cannot effectively pump as much, and will try to pump faster to accommodate the lesser fluid volume that is available. The container will try to constrict down and make itself smaller to accommodate the lesser fluid volume. That's just one example of how the other two parts are affected when one part is affected by a traumatic event or a disease state. Let's start with the basics, and this would be the most basic thing we do as far as tracking patients, and that's getting a basic vital sign like heart rate. Heart rate is the pulse that we take. It's a vital sign that we use to measure the ventricular contractions per minute. That's what we're measuring when that pulse beat comes through when we're measuring and palpating an artery. We're feeling the pulse wave of a ventricular contraction. In an adult, that normal is about 60 to 100 beats per minute. And people can be tachycardic or bradycardic based upon whether they are fast or slow, respectively. But this is the basic number we start with, and we would be remiss if we didn't at least talk about heart rate briefly. Let's talk about stroke volume. Now, stroke volume has an equation that looks like this if you're watching the video version. Stroke volume equals the end diastolic volume minus the end systolic volume. Now, you have to think about that. Usually, we think about diastole as the small number in a blood pressure reading, but in diastolic, an end diastolic volume is that volume in the ventricles after the diastolic resting phase when everything is getting pre-filled. Okay, that's after that atrial contraction before the ventricular contraction, and that's when the heart is most full of blood in the ventricles. So end diastolic volume minus end systolicular volume. Systolic volume will give you the stroke volume. So if we have an average end diastolic volume of 120, and at the end of the systole, at the end of the contraction of the ventricles, we have a blood volume in the ventricles of 50, that means we're going to have a stroke volume of 70. So what do we look at as part of the whole picture? Well, this is very important for a couple of reasons. Stroke volume is part of the equation of several other numbers we're going to deal with. So we need to really understand how stroke volume works. And we're looking at that one stroke, how much blood is pumped out by the ventricles. And the amount pumped out by each ventricle is roughly equal. So if there's 70 being pushed out of the left ventricle, there's probably about 70 being pushed out of the right ventricle. That can change if one of the ventricles is diseased, has had a heart attack, has dealt with, has some kind of ischemia going on. But ultimately, they are very much the same in a normal patient. What about ejection fraction? Talked about that there briefly. This is the percentage of blood pumped by the ventricles. Of the blood that was in the ventricles before it contracted, how much of it, what percentage of it was actually pushed out? It doesn't push out all of the blood. Some of the blood remains in there. So how effective of a pump is the ventricle? And this is a measure of that in adults. Ejection fraction equals the stroke volume divided by the end diastolic volume, okay? And that'll give you a decimal number. It's a fraction, okay? And then if you multiply it by 100, you'll get the percentage, right? So if we have 0.58 from our numbers before in ejection fraction, that would be 58% of the blood was ejected. On average, the normal people would experience a norm of 55 to 70% ejection fraction, depending on the individual, how healthy they are, their cardiovascular and respiratory status, all the things that go into how physically fit they are. You get better ejection fractions from a healthier heart, obviously. A low ejection fraction is a strong predictor of poor outcomes. So if you see something like this show up, it is somebody says they have an ejection fraction less than 50%. This is a bad thing. It means that they are below average. They are not pumping effectively, and they are not going to be perfusing their end organs very well because the heart is not being able to pump effectively. The ejection fraction is most often measured by ultrasound, where they go ahead and get that heart Doppler and take a look and see what's going on. Cardiac output is in this equation, heart rate times stroke volume. Remember, that's why we talk about heart rate and stroke volume first, because they show up so often in other things. And this is a value that is timed. It's per minute. So that's why we use the heart rate in there. So it's how much blood is the heart putting out in an average minute, the cardiac output per minute. It is focused often on the left ventricular output, although remember, sometimes it can be modified and talk about the total output of both ventricles, but we should remember that often, usually that is an equal figure on both sides. So you can talk about one ventricle and usually be talking about what would be going on the other side of the heart as well. It's related to ejection fraction, and remember that the ejection fraction number is a function of stroke volume as well. And so cardiac output of somebody with a poor ejection fraction, you know they are having a less than optimal cardiac output. So you need to understand what that patient is dealing with physiologically. Is the cardiovascular system working effectively or not, is what the cardiac output tells you. It's something that the ejection fraction will tell you as well, but you can get a sense of what the cardiac output is reading as well. Now, the next up is something we do very commonly as well, and I could have covered this earlier, but I thought we needed to get some other numbers under our belts first to talk a little bit about blood pressure. And I'm going to talk about non-invasive blood pressure because that's what we most often deal with. Blood pressure is cardiac output times the peripheral vascular resistance. Now, gee, what are we talking about there? You know, peripheral vascular resistance. How do we measure that? Well, internally, we could put a pressure gauge inside one of the vessels and measure the pressure inside the vessel, and we can do it that way. But it's basically the heart pumping against the smaller tubes at the other end of the vascular system. You know, when you get out in the far end of the container, the vessels, and you get how good is the heart at pumping blood through the capillary beds to the low pressure side of the system, the venous side of the system. So this is what non-invasive blood pressure, when we do that with a blood pressure cuff, we are looking at how well the container is responding along with the cardiac output. We use a sphygmomanometer. I hope I said that right. I can never see if I say it right, but that's the big word for blood pressure cuff, which is much easier to say. And you need to make sure you use a properly sized blood pressure cuff for the individual and location upon which you're taking a blood pressure. So make sure you go through that. That's a whole nother video segment. Systolic is the ventricular beat pressure. That's the larger number, the first number we're going to detect when we come down from pumping up the blood pressure cuff. And then the second number we're trying to detect is the diastolic, which is the resting arterial pressure. And those two numbers are that upper and lower number we get with blood pressure. Pulse pressure is something that someone asked me about in an email recently, and that's what prompted me to go into this particular topic here. Pulse pressure is the systolic blood pressure minus the diastolic blood pressure. It's the difference between those two numbers. And normally that number is 30 to 40 millimeters of mercury, okay? When that's the number we use or the value we use to measure blood pressure. It is normally 30 to 40. When someone is exercising or very, very active, that number can go up to 100 or more. And think about it. It makes sense. As the heart rate increases, as it pushes out more blood into the vascular system, that systolic number is going to go up. The peripheral vascular resistance is moving blood around and clamping down in different places based upon the activity that's going on. And so you can have that number go up pretty high. However, it's going to return to normal most often when someone reaches a resting state. This is a partial measure of cardiac output. Since we can't really determine the stroke volume and measure it effectively, we don't always have an ultrasound in our back pocket to do that, or the knowledge to do that, we can use pulse pressure as a kind of measure of cardiac output. A narrow pulse pressure, you know, if it's less than 30 millimeters of mercury, if the numbers are starting to get very close together, the systolic and diastolic readings, that's a sign that the heart is not pumping effectively. Okay, and it could be a sign of a couple of different things. It could be a sign of cardiac tamponade. It could be a sign if there's a suspicion of trauma or you know the patient has experienced trauma. It could be a sign of blood loss, so hypovolemia. And so if you've got a patient that was in a car accident and you don't think they're bleeding, they don't think they're very seriously injured, and you start taking a series of blood pressures and you notice that the pulse pressure is narrowing, it could be a sign of an internal bleed. And it's something to keep in the back of your mind. It can also be a sign of congestive heart failure. Again, the heart is not pumping effectively, and whatever the reason is for that is why this number is narrowing. Widened pulse pressure is usually a sign, as we said, of exertion or activity. It can also be a sign of decreased peripheral vascular resistance and it's a sign of atherosclerosis. The great vessels are becoming hardened, the hardening of the arteries you hear about. This is when the aortic arch becomes hardened. And usually that arch is pretty flexible. And in a healthy person, the elastic fibers in that expand and absorb some of the shock of the ventricular contraction so that the pressure going out to the rest of the system is actually absorbed a little bit and not as high. If that it becomes just a hard pipe and it is no longer flexing the way it's supposed to, then more of the pressure is transmitted into the rest of the system and you get a widened pulse pressure. So it's something to just be aware of. But in the context of emergency services, we're more concerned with a narrowing pulse pressure. What's mean arterial pressure? Is this something we can even measure in the field? Well, it's the perfusion pressure. This is the average arterial pressure in the entire body, and it is a measure of how effectively the blood is getting out to the rest of the system, and is it reaching its end organs? It's a measure of blood flow and also an estimated formula. This is one of those things that we can measure using internal measurement techniques, but we are not going to do invasive techniques just to get a mean arterial pressure, and not all of them are very effective or very reliable anyway. But you can estimate this using this particular equation here. Mean arterial pressure equals diastolic pressure plus 1/3 of pulse pressure. So I've been trying to build on the different things here. If you can get the pulse pressure, which is the difference between the diastolic and systolic pressure, blood pressure, then you take the diastolic pressure again plus 1/3 of the pulse pressure, and that is your average mean arterial pressure. It's a good estimate most of the time. Now, what do you do with this? What does this mean? Well, if it gets lower, if it gets below 60, say, and your mean arterial pressure is less than 60, you can begin to suspect this patient has poor perfusion, that they are not adequately supplying blood, oxygen, and the other materials necessary for life to all of the end organs, or they may not be. Now, this is one of those things where you treat the patient, not the number. You may have a patient who has an unusually low blood pressure. They're a marathon runner or something like that, and they're resting heart rate is incredibly low, their resting blood pressure is very low, and they just sitting there looking at you can have a low mean arterial pressure. But you treat the patient, not the number. But in the case of a patient with a suspected cardiac problem or perhaps a suspected trauma or an actual trauma, you can use this to get a judge of whether or not this patient is becoming perfused adequately. So let's put it all together. What do you need to do to get along with this? We've talked about some of it. You need to get a good history on your patient. You need to take careful vital signs using proper technique and proper tools for the job. You need to consider all of the factors in the big picture. You don't just look at one of these numbers and take it out of context. None of these numbers live in a vacuum. They all relate to everything else. And I hope I've showed that adequately here. So you need to take into that consideration the patient, the vital signs, the history, and the medications the patient's taking. I mean, good grief, if they're taking beta blockers, that throws their heart rate off. That artificially slows down their heart rate, decreases their cardiac output and stroke volume. It's going to affect their blood pressure, and we may not be looking at a real number here because medications are changing the way this patient is presenting. So all of that needs to be taken together. And then you take these other cardiac numbers, things like pulse pressure, things like mean arterial pressure, and you keep them in the back of your mind and combine them with your normal vital signs to get a better idea of what seems to be going on inside with your patient. I hope you like that particular review, and if you have any questions or if I've left something out or misspoken, please get back in touch with me. Send emails in to podmedic@mac.com. I'd love to hear from you, and you can let me know what you think of this particular segment. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and remind you to please head over and check out all of the information that's available for you at the MedicCast website. MedicCast.com/blog is where you want to go for the podcast. And check out the video version of the show there. You can also check out all of the articles and different information that's posted throughout the course of the week, as well as links to our Facebook page and a whole lot more, all over at the MedicCast blog. And of course, the show notes for each episode. That will give you the information to the news articles, the links to all of that stuff, as well as additional resource links for the tip of the week that week. And we want you to follow up on that so that you can have the best possible information and be able to be the best care provider for your patients. And so please take that opportunity. And of course, recommend the MedicCast to people you know. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. I respond back to every email I get, and I love to hear from you, so keep those emails coming in with your comments, your suggestions, questions you might have, all of that. Send them in to podmedic@mac.com. If you'd like to get back in touch with me over on Twitter or Facebook, you can do so. Send them or contact me over there by reaching out to me on twitter.com/podmedic. or facebook.com/podmedic, and I'm Podmedic pretty much everywhere in the social media space. You can also catch up with the MedicCast fan page, over 3,000 fans over there and growing. So if you haven't become a fan of the MedicCast, head over to facebook.com/MedicCast and you can become a fan. Just click the like button there. And of course, for all of you that are already fans, thanks a lot. And continue to share the information from that page and sending in, clicking your like buttons and leaving comments, all very important ways to support the show. And we really appreciate that. I know I do. I love to respond back to everybody and check in with folks over on the MedicCast fan page. That's going to go ahead and close out the show. Don't forget to come and check us out at EMS World Expo. And more information about that from the beginning of the show or over on the MedicCast website. We look forward to seeing all of you there. In the meantime, I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. I'll be back again next Monday with another episode of the MedicCast. In the meantime, please remember to stay safe and remember, seen safety, BSI.